All right. John chapter 12, let's read in verse 1. It says, "Then 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, who had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead. There they made him a supper, and Martha served. But Lazarus was one of those who sat at the table with him. Then Mary took a pound of very costly oil of spikenard, anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the oil. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who would betray him, said, 'Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?' This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief, and he had the money box, and he used to take what was put in it. But Jesus said, 'Let her alone. She's kept this for the day of my burial. For the poor you have with you always, but me, you don't have always.'" For years, the church has emphasized evangelism, teaching, fellowship, missions, and service to the neglect of the very source of its power, worship. So says Robert E. Weber, anyway, American theologian. What he says here certainly should give us pause to consider whether or not we place as great an emphasis on worship as he seems to. But the fact of the matter is that worship is to be a very foundational aspect of the Christian life. I would go so far as to say that, at least in some respect, worship ought to be the primary occupation of every Christian. Reason being, A, Jesus deserves it, and B, it's what we're going to be doing forever. And if we're hesitant to give him the worship that is due now, I can only say that eternity might not look so bright, because it is going to be our primary occupation sooner or later if it isn't already. Worship should not be what we do, but who we are. And I'll tell you this as well. For those of us in this room that are truly born again, there will come a day when worship is what we do all day, every day. And I'll tell you that when that day comes, we'll be a lot better at it than we are right now. Okay? So I'm making a basic statement here that says we're none of us are as good at worship as we perhaps ought to be, and for sure one day will be. And if that's true, then you and I have the capacity to improve on the quality of the worship that we offer Christ, if we want to. So we need to begin with this question, at least in our minds: do you want to be a better worshiper than you think you already are? Yeah, I wonder, when was the last time perhaps that you even considered such a question? When was the last time we stopped to evaluate our worship? Maybe some of us in this room, we evaluate our service. You have meetings with small group leaders or your pastor, and you kind of, how are things going? You consider your sacrifice, maybe your financial sacrifices. You look at your schedule and you go, wow, I'm really giving a lot of time to the church. I gave up last weekend and this weekend, and then next weekend also I'm booked because the church is a busy church. And so you evaluate your sacrifice. You evaluate your service. But do we evaluate the worship that we give? Now, I need to clarify something right off the bat, because for some of you, when I say worship, you automatically think that I mean singing, which singing is worship, but that's not all that it is. And if it's all that it was, then some of us would have no hope, because there's no way you're getting any better at singing. I heard you. I just heard you. Okay? And that's the nice thing about coming down to a bigger church. Mine is so small, it's hard to hide a crummy voice behind, you know, two other people. But here, we all join in and it sounds all right. Sounds wonderful, in fact, and I'm happy to be part of this. But we sometimes falsely relegate worship to the arena of singing, like we do when we get together for church, which happens only for 20 minutes, maybe, a week. If you add Wednesdays, if you're that committed, than maybe a half an hour or so. I certainly hope that worship transcends singing, because if that's the case, then we're not worshiping like we ought to. Worship is more than singing. Take this description of what true worship is by one author who says, quote, "The Bible describes worship in physical terms. The root meaning for the Hebrew word, we translate worship, is to prostrate. To lay down flat is kind of the idea. The word bless literally means to kneel. Thanksgiving refers to an extension of the hand. Throughout Scripture, we find a variety of physical postures in connection with worship. Lying prostrate, standing, kneeling, lifting the hands, clapping the hands, lifting the head, bowing the head, dancing, and wearing sackcloth and ashes. The point is that we are to offer God our bodies as well as all the rest of our being. Worship is appropriately physical." End quote. So we need to understand this morning that worship is more than singing. True worship of God is demonstrated in a wide variety of ways. And if you look at the categories that were just read, you are likely to identify more closely with some over others, because most people worship according to their own personal preferences. Did you get that? Most people, I dare say most of us in this room, worship God according to our own personal preferences. So what are your preferences? Are you the one that would lie prostrate, or would you stand? Because those are two extremely different postures physically and two extremely different postures spiritually. Lying down and standing up, neither of which is better than the other. One of which is more preferable to you. Which one is it? Are you more likely to worship Jesus when you're broken and humble, as illustrated by lying prostrate? Or are you more likely to worship Jesus when you're strong in the Lord and in His mighty power, which would be signified by standing and ready? Do you best worship Christ with a dancing temperament? I saw all the interpretive dancing happening 10 minutes ago, jumping in the aisles and such. Not really. Represented maybe by joy? Do you best worship Christ when you're filled with gratitude and uncontainable excitement? Or perhaps you're the opposite and you worship Jesus best with a sackcloth and ashes kind of mood. Sober, solemn, serious. Do you like to lift your hands? Not necessarily when you sing. Or do you like to clap your hands? Again, maybe physically, or maybe speaking more along the lines of spiritually. Do you lift your head or do you bow your head? Everybody has preferences in the way that they choose to offer Christ their worship, and that includes the members of a first century Jewish family in Bethany, Israel. Lazarus' family. We just read the first 8 verses of John chapter 12, which introduces us, if we're not already familiar, with a family of children by name of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. And what we read has already revealed that they too worship Jesus according to personal preferences. And I'll go through this with you. Go to verse 2, where it says that they made him a supper. They made him a supper. Now, I would argue that this is in itself a sort of form of worship. Okay? Now, a bit of the backstory here on this account is that their brother, Lazarus, had several days ago died and been buried, and had been then buried for 4 days, which at that point would have been a fairly advanced stage of decay and stench. Jesus comes to the grave and resurrects him after 4 days. This would have stunned the community, let alone Mary and Martha, his sisters. So I dare say that this supper would have been a celebration, an occasion for such celebration. And it's a form of worship. For Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, hospitality was their way of expressing that gratitude. Again, this is worship. Now, it says that in verse 1 that it was 6 days before the Passover, which to me says that they could have just waited 6 days and worshiped God in the same predictable way that they had always done, in the same predictable way that the rest of the nation would do, and they could have offered God their worship because it was on the schedule. But they strayed from the schedule and decided to have supper. They made him supper. That's what they wanted to do. Nobody was forcing them to do this. It was their choice. They chose to do it just like we do when we worship Jesus. We do it the way we choose to. There's some reason it's preferable to us, and so we follow through with it. And then it says that Martha served. This is no surprise to anybody who knows the Gospels, because every time we read about Martha, she's serving. She's got a reputation for it. It's part of her character. It's what she does. Now, she could have chosen to worship Jesus in a very different way, something that kind of challenged the norm for her. She could have sat quietly at his feet, but she didn't. And again, no one is forcing her to serve. That's just part of who she is. Again, she chose to occupy that position, and so she too is worshiping Jesus according to her own preferences. And then you've got Lazarus. What's he doing? In verse 2, it says that he's sitting there with Jesus, which also is an act of worship. You don't necessarily need to stand. You don't necessarily need to sing. You don't necessarily need to lift your hands. Sometimes being still and quiet can be just as much an act of worship if it brings you into the presence of Christ, which it's doing for him. He's just sitting there by Jesus, which if I'm dead for 4 days and he yanks me out of that, I want to stay close to him, right? So he ain't leaving. And he's there close to Christ, which kind of seems to be part of Lazarus's character. I don't know a lot about him. There isn't a lot of detail in the Gospels concerning Lazarus, but from what we can glean, it seems that he was a rather passive man. In Luke chapter 10, we read that Mary and Martha had invited Jesus to dinner prior to this event, and Lazarus isn't even mentioned at all. So we don't know if he's there, but if he is, he's kind of in the background. The only thing that the Gospels really reveal about Lazarus is that he died and was resurrected. Those are two very passive activities, okay? Doesn't take a lot to die, and it takes absolutely nothing to resurrect. And then here we see him just sitting there with Jesus. Now, Lazarus, too, could have done what came unnatural to him in offering worship to Christ. He could have served with Martha. We never seen him doing that before. Maybe he should have challenged himself and went, you know what? I'm going to serve. I know it's totally out of character, but I'm going to do what doesn't come naturally because I want to show Jesus that I care. And I doubt that Martha would have complained at all. She has a reputation for getting kind of cranky when people don't help her. But he didn't. Some people prefer to worship quietly and privately and passively. And Jesus isn't complaining about that. But to make my point, Lazarus is doing what everybody else thus far is doing in worshiping Jesus according to his own personal preferences. And I'll bet that we do too. And that's not to condemn anybody, honestly. That's not my point at all. It's to challenge us. Like, have we fallen into a routine with worship, like weekly? This is what we do on Sunday. This is how I sing. Good grief, I never put my hands in the air. If I do that now, people are going to think I'm weird because I've been coming here for 13 years and I've never put my hands in the air. But man, I would like to. My heart is so soft right now. And I'd come up the aisle and kneel down, but everybody's watching. I'd like to give Jesus more than I have in the past, but I'm just not sure how. And quite frankly, I'm not sure what people will think. This is meant at least to push you a little bit and go, it's okay. There's nothing wrong with the way these guys chose to worship, but I want you to consider a few things, okay? Number one, none of their worship cost very much. Lazarus' worship sitting there next to Jesus, what did it cost him? Absolutely nothing. Martha's service? Not much, nothing more than a bit of physical exertion. But hey, it's what she does. Maybe the biggest act of worship, the most costly of all the worship we've read in the first two verses was supper. I don't know how much it cost for a traditional, typical supper in Jewish culture in the first century. And I don't know how many people were there. So it may have been a bit of an expense, but not very much. And some worship is like that. And praise God that he allows us to worship him in very inexpensive ways. Doesn't, you know, right? Monday I had a meeting and it was only a couple miles away, so I took my bike. And I was biking on a trail, and the weather happened to be okay. And that made me sing out loud to God, because I was all by myself, and I don't care what birds think. And I made up a worship song, and it was actually really good, but of course I forgot it. Since you'll never hear it, I might as well say it was actually awesome. I mean, the crescendo was like, even deer were like, But it was free. It didn't cost me anything. It was actually quite energizing. It gave me. Some worship is like that. But I want you to notice that none of the worship we've seen thus far cost very much, nor did any of the worship that we've seen thus far threaten their social standing. None of what we read of in verse 2 made anybody look bad. In our Midwest culture, this kind of worship actually gets you points. Like hospitality. You have somebody over for dinner in the Midwest. If the dinner's decent, you just got points. It's what you do to earn favor, correct? You have supper for your friends. You cook dinner for the neighbors. That's what you do, and everybody thinks you're great. Serving, like Martha, she ain't losing ground. No way would that happen here. That will actually, some people might mistakenly use service around here as a badge of honor. So you don't lose points for doing any of the worship that they've done thus far. Okay? Third point, none of the worship we've seen thus far got them attacked. Nobody's going after them for the supper. What's this? Nobody's going after them for the service. Nobody attacks you for leaving them alone like Lazarus did. If that's the way you want to worship Jesus, that's fine. What you got going on with God is good for you and God, but what I got going is gone. So you leave me alone. You worship Jesus how you want, and I'll worship the devil how I please. Nobody has a problem with you leaving them alone. Nobody has a problem with you worshiping Jesus through service. They're not going to... Can't believe you're serving me. Can't believe you cooked me dinner. Ain't going to happen. Maybe that's why we prefer to worship Jesus like we do. I want you to consider that. Maybe that's why you've chosen to worship Jesus the way that you are known for worshiping Jesus, because it doesn't cost you too much. And because it reinforces your social standing. And because it's safe. No one has a problem with the way you serve Jesus, and you get to live a quiet life. So please, this morning, don't only consider the way in which you prefer to serve Jesus, but also why it is that you prefer to serve him that way. Okay? Now in verse 3 it says, Then Mary, we're being introduced now to an example of worship that deserves to be highlighted by itself. Supper is, you know, the detail, not a whole lot given there. That's not the focal point of this text, but, you know, it wasn't left out, but supper isn't the point. Martha's service isn't the point either, though it does get honorable mention. But here, Mary's worship of Jesus takes center stage. So the Holy Spirit wants us to notice something about her worship, because there are some demonstrations of worship that surpass all others. There are some demonstrations of worship that surpass all others. What makes worship like that so remarkable? One, if you want to be a better worshiper, then ask yourself how much the way you currently worship right now costs you. Because unlike the worship of her brother and sister, Mary's worship cost her dearly. Tells us that she took a pound of very costly oil of spikenard. Oil, perfume. Commentary tells us that this would have been, in that day, roughly $12,000 in value, which would have been equivalent to a typical year's wage. This is extremely valuable. Most likely a family heirloom. Bible doesn't tell us where Mary got her hands on such a valuable treasure. If it wasn't a family heirloom, perhaps it was meant to become one. But I want you to think of this. The amount of money that you make in one whole year of full-time employment, wherever it is that you work, is the same amount that she spent on Jesus in one single verse. How's that for expensive worship? The amount you make in one whole year is the amount she spent in one single verse. That takes faith, I suppose. I mean, you don't meet people very often who are just willing to dump their love on Christ so lavishly that it puts their future in jeopardy. But she did. That sets her worship in a different category than cooking supper for a friend, doesn't it? Or serving the family of God, doesn't it? Or sitting next to Jesus and basking in his love for you. This is remarkable. It takes faith. She knows that the real reason that God has given her that perfume at all was to spend it on Jesus. I don't know how old she is. I don't know how many times she passed by the shelf that had been sitting on. I don't know how many times she had looked at that perfume and wondered why she even had it or what she was going to do with it. But at this point in her own little world, she decides, I know why I have that perfume. It's clear now why God gave me such an expensive treasure. It's to spend it on Jesus. What do you have that's most valuable to you? It's probably not perfume. It might not even be a thing. It could be a person. What's most valuable to you? It could be a relationship that you're in currently. What do you least likely want to sacrifice for Christ? It could be a pursuit. A lot of young people in the room investing in college. Want a career. Some of us are making moves to upgrade our life. Could be an investment you've made, something financial. It doesn't matter. What to you is most valuable to you? And has it ever crossed your mind that the real reason God might have given you whatever that is to spend it on Jesus? Have you ever entertained that thought? Has it ever dawned on you that all you have, the good stuff and the bad, was given you by God and that there might be a reason for it? Few people will ever consider that. There's a guy in the Bible that we know of as the rich young ruler. He's a guy who never considered that. He never considered that God may have just made him as rich as he did in order to sell everything and give it to the people around him that were poor. Never crossed his mind, but it crossed Jesus' mind, and so Jesus sprung that on him at a moment when he wasn't ready to hear it, and he lost the opportunity to do with what God had given him the reason that God had given it to him in the first place. Never crossed his mind, but it did cross Jesus' mind, and here now it crosses Mary's mind that maybe this great valuable vial of perfume that's been sitting on my shelf year after year collecting dust, maybe the whole reason I have it is to give it up and glorify God in the process. Now, you have something like that. I'll tell you that you have something like that. And I'm not telling you to give it away, and I'm not telling you what to do with it. I'm only asking that you consider, lest you spend the rest of your life never having done so and miss the opportunity to do with what God gave you the very thing that He gave it to you for. She spends it all on Christ. That oil was not her most valuable treasure. Jesus was. Jesus was. Where your treasure is, that's where your heart's going to be. We know where her heart was. Her heart was given to Christ. It wasn't the license. Which one's more valuable? Year's wage, you know, a vial of oil, or Jesus Christ? If you ask Mary, she's going to go, well, Jesus, oil didn't bring my brother back. What good is this oil? My brother was dead. Day after day after day after day, dead for four in a row, and that oil sat there doing nothing. Jesus comes along and brings him back to life. What will it take for us to realize how little value some of the things that we have in our life that we cherish so much actually hold? Do you want to be a better worshiper? Then consider how much it costs you to worship the way you currently do. Here's a second thing to consider if you want to be a better worshiper. How bad does it make you look to worship the way you currently do? Because unlike the worship of her brother and sister, Mary's worship threatened her social standing. The way she chose to worship Jesus made her look real bad in front of everybody. So money wasn't the only thing that she was sacrificing that day. That oil, that perfume, there was more to it than that. There's a couple of details here that we don't want to overlook. Rich families at that time commonly had both Jewish and Gentile servants. Reason being, there were some tasks that were so low, they were beneath even the lowest of Jewish servants to perform. So they had to hire Gentile servants to do those things, among which was washing feet. No Jew, not even the lowest of Jewish slaves, were expected to do that. And what's Mary doing? She's washing Jesus' feet. So listen, this is a woman who is so enamored with Christ, she isn't afraid of doing what's beneath her. She's not afraid to do what's beneath her. It's a truly humble woman. And in ancient Jewish culture, a woman's hair spoke 1,000 words about that woman's character. Jewish women were always careful, if they wanted to maintain their dignity, to wear it up in public. That's how she maintained a reputation. Any woman who let her hair down was sending a clear message about her morals to the public, and it wasn't a positive message. Mary is letting her hair down to wash Jesus' feet, and she's doing it publicly. So here we see Mary letting go not just of that which was of great monetary value to her, but also she's letting go of what is, in some circles, far more lucrative to a lot of women that I see. She's letting go of her public image. I don't want to pick on women or sound sexist here, but there are many who would far rather let go of what is financially valuable than what is personally advantageous, that being their public image. Mary, by letting her hair down in front of Jesus and his men, is inviting judgment. She's inviting rumors to be spread. She's inviting criticisms and opinions from the peanut gallery. And there she is, doing it anyway. She's sacrificing her own reputation in order to worship Jesus. And she knows how cheap it's going to make her look in front of everybody. But unlike some women today, and men also for that matter, she didn't worship Jesus for how it made her look. This is a woman who worshiped Jesus in spite of how it made her look. What would it cost you to do that? Think of the suspicion that you might generate among friends and family and those whose opinions you hold in highest regard. Think of what they would think of you if you decided to do what Mary did and exhaust your most precious treasures in order to serve and worship Jesus like he deserves. What do you got that if you let go of, the people around you would begin to scoff? Maybe even people in this room would feel outdone by your worship and begin to covertly critique you, belittle you, diminish the value of your sacrifice. Think of what that might do and what it is that would be required to let go of in order for that kind of a response to be warranted. Hope for marriage, single people. You go home, visit mom and dad, and make the announcement that you have decided to remain single for the rest of your life because you know that you're far more valuable to the kingdom of God as a single man or woman than you are as married. How's mom and dad going to handle that? What do you mean, no grandkids? How about homes? What would people think if you decided that I'm not going to chase the American dream, I'm not going to do this? It's a whole list. Business, education, careers, property, children, whatever it is. What would people say? What would people say? You look at verses 4 and 5, everybody's got something to say. Judas just can't contain himself anymore. He jumps in with his critique. Why wasn't this sold? Do you want to be a better worshiper? Well, then take the plunge. Is there risk involved in worshiping the way that you currently do? Because when we look at Mary, we see that unlike her sister and unlike her brother, Mary's worship got her attacked. No sooner does she lose herself in the worship of Jesus Christ and some compromised disciple, nonetheless, is there to minimize, to pull her back down to earth. And it says that it was his disciple, one of Christ's disciples. The more lavish and the more reverent and the more sincere your worship of Christ gets, the more likely it is to generate hostility in those who belong to the devil. It's really hard to worship Jesus with all your heart and all your mind and all your body and all your strength like we're supposed to and not have people notice. It's hard to worship Jesus like we're supposed to and not irritate somebody and not garner negative criticism. It's almost a guarantee. I mean, how predictable is this that verse 5 finds its way into what is perhaps one of the greatest acts of worship that we see Jesus receive throughout his entire public ministry? It's funny how the closer you draw to Christ, the more you can almost count on somebody trying to throw dirt in your eyes. The more you gaze upon him with eyes of adoration, suddenly somebody's there to... I was, in fact, studying for this at a coffee house. I was preparing this message, and I'm lost in meditative thoughts of Christ and truth and trying to focus, talking, you know, like worship, kind of, maybe. And I look over my shoulder, and there's a woman standing right here, and I could sense hostility before I even turned. She pulls down her glasses and sneers at me. So I stared at her. And she goes, "That's fiction, you know." And I said, "I know for certain that it is not." I said, if it's fiction, why do you have such a problem with it? We're not arguing about the Wizard of Oz. And then she said some things and left. So, the devil does not want you to worship God. He'll do whatever he needs to do in order to stop that from happening. There's a devotional Bible out there that has this written in it. The devil hates to see God honored. He will do anything to stop this. In fact, he would really like to steal this affection for himself. Knowing that, what will it take for you? What level of determination is required to worship Jesus in the way that endures the attack that's guaranteed to happen if you do? And are you willing to step foot into such hostile territory? Mary didn't let intimidation stop her from worshiping Jesus like she did, and neither should we. Unlike the worship of her brother and sister, Mary's worship cost her dearly. Mary's worship threatened her social standing. Mary's worship got her attacked. And last, unlike the worship offered by her brother and her sisters, Mary's worship was remarkable. Do you know what remarkable means? It means worthy of remark. Did you notice that verses 7 and 8 are written in red ink? If you've got a red ink Bible, and do you know what that means? It means that Jesus is making a remark. And he's remarking about her worship, the way that she chose to worship Christ, her devotion to Jesus there, in spite of what it cost her, in spite of the attack, in spite of the risk, caused Christ to make a remark. He says nothing about the supper. He says nothing about the service Martha gave, and he says nothing about the affection Lazarus had. None of that worship struck him like Mary's did. Now listen, he accepted the supper. He had nothing bad to say about it. He accepted the service. He accepted the affection from Lazarus. But only Mary's was worthy of Christ's remarks. Her worship of Christ was, by definition, remarkable. Only hers was as expensive. Only hers was a threat to her own reputation. Only hers was attacked. And only Mary's worship was worthy of Christ's remarks. Do you want to worship Jesus in a remarkable way? I hope that we do. I think, maybe, we do. And if so, then you need to answer some of these questions and go, does it cost that much to do what I do? Is it that risky, or am I playing it safe? Am I being attacked because of my love for Christ? Worship comes in many forms. Worship can be demonstrated in a variety of ways. Everybody has their preferences, including us. And I'd say this. Most of us are probably already locked into such a predictable style or way of worshiping Jesus in our life that we no longer surprise him or anybody else by it. Martha's a good example of that. Nobody's surprised that Martha is serving in verse 2. That's fine. But there is a form of worship that's so unconventional to the worshiper. There is a way of worship that is so uncharacteristic of you, so unexpected, that it leaves the realm of acceptable and becomes remarkable. It would make talk. And we don't have to wait till heaven to achieve that level and that quality of worship. We can do it now. Because listen, we all have room to improve on this, don't we? unless you think you're already in heaven, this isn't heaven. One day we will worship Christ perfectly and forever, but for now, we have room to grow. Jesus deserves that from us. Now. Mary didn't wait till heaven to give him everything she had. She did it while it was still an opportunity. Every single one of us is capable of that. Should we give it a shot? Let's all stand and worship. Stand with me.